Chapter 3, Saturday Night Live, Not the Drug Part. In the spring of 1975, a William Morris agent named Herb Karp saw Franken and Davis at the Comedy Store and asked us to put together a writing sample. We knew we weren't right for the few comedy variety shows on TV at the time. The Carol Burnett Show was terrific, but from another generation. The Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, though slightly superior to the BoobTube Review, was, well, dreck. So Tom and I wrote a 14-page submission for a hypothetical show that we'd like to work for. It included a news segment, our World War III newscast, a sketch about a bad variety show, a commercial parody, and the script for a short conceptual film. Even now, almost 50 years later, I still harbor the faint hope that someone, somewhere, will someday do a show like that. A few months later, a 30-year-old producer named Lorne Michaels read our writing sample for a new late-night show he was putting together. We got the word that we'd been hired from Herb late on a Friday afternoon after playing basketball with some other unemployed comedians in Hollywood. Be at 30 Rockefeller Plaza on Monday. Of the writers hired for the original SNL staff, Tom and I were the only ones Lorne hadn't met. Dick Ebersol, then the network exec in charge of late night, wanted to hire another team who were from New York in order to save NBC the airfare, but Lorne insisted on us. Tom and I came as a team, and since this was our first job in TV, NBC got a waiver from the Writers Guild to allow them to pay us as a single apprentice writer. We couldn't have been happier. When we arrived on Monday, July 7th, 1975, the first colleague we met was Mike O'Donohue, already legendary for his hilariously dark work as a founding writer of the National Lampoon. As the three of us waited for clearance at the elevator bank, Mike sized us up and asked Tom and me what we were being paid. We told him we were sharing $350 a week. Mike snickered, "I spend that much to shine my cat's shoes." Tom and I were delighted. We soon met some of the other writers, including Chevy Chase and Garrett Morris, who were yet to be named cast members. At that point, Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner, whom Lorne knew from Toronto, and Lorraine Newman, who had performed at the Groundlings, an improv-based theater in L.A., were the only cast members. A week or so later, John Belushi, a Second City vet, arrived at the audition as his samurai character and blew the room away. John and Jane Curtin, who came from The Proposition in Boston, yet another improv-based theater, rounded out the not-ready-for-primetime players. Lorne had bargained with NBC for a long pre-production period. Part of the idea was to give us time to write a lot and start forging a common sensibility as a staff. During pre-production, Tom and I would meet periodically with Lorne in his office to go over something we'd written. He'd always ask us the same question, "Is this the best piece you've ever written?" We'd say no, and then Lorne would tell us to keep working on it until it was. Finally, one of us, and I'm guessing it was Tom, figured out that not everything you write can be the best thing you've ever written. Lorne dropped that particular gambit after that, but over the years, every so often, we would write the best thing we'd ever written. Tom and I got the sense that Lorne was looking out for us. He himself had started in Toronto as part of a team, Hart and Lorne, and I think Lorne appreciated the bond between us. Around the show, Tom and I were called the boys. Even if just one of us walked into the room, someone would say, "The boys are here." The first show was scheduled for October 11th, 1975. As the premiere approached, I grew increasingly confident that we were all aboard a giant hit. It was the first time that baby boomers had been allowed to do TV, and the people around me were among the most talented writers and comedians of our generation. When I look back on that youthful arrogance, I laugh. This was our first real job in show business. Hits almost never happen. But Tom and I had gotten a raise, and Franny and Tom's girlfriend Lucy drove east from California with our belongings because we were confident that we had a long-term job. On October 2nd, 1975, 9 days before the first Saturday Night Live ever, Franny and I eloped and were married at City Hall in Lower Manhattan. Of course, I had been correct as a brash, overconfident 24-year-old. The show was pretty much an instant hit. Over the decades, SNL has gone through periods of sustained brilliance and a few rough patches, but after 42 years, the show has been a touchstone for generations of over-entertained, under-informed Americans. Lauren started putting Franken and Davis in front of the camera every once in a while. We'd be part of the dress rehearsal, and if enough stuff in dress tanked, he put us on the air. Our first appearance was on a show hosted by Elliot Gould. We did a bit from our act called the Bureau of White Man Affairs. The premise was simple. What if the Indians had won? I played the hosts of Powwow with the Press, Howard K. Screaming Eagle, and Tom played the chief of the Bureau of White Man Affairs, both wearing hats and fedoras with a feather sticking out. The topic, recent complaints over racially insensitive team nicknames in Major League Lacrosse, such as the Milwaukee Dagos. Tom. We had a big uproar about a week ago over an insignia, a bubblegum card for the Cleveland Kikes. They objected to the little screaming rabbi, me. Well, can't these names be offensive to white people? No. These are white man names that the white man uses himself to ridicule each other's tribe. Oh, I didn't know that. Yes, for example, the Dago is an Italian, whom we know are a stupid, violent, greasy people. They wear black pointy moccasins. And a Kike is a Jew, white man, and he's the most shrewd of all white men, as you probably know. Yes, I understand that the Jew white man really knows the value of a buffalo chip. It was Bob and Ray with an edge. 40 years later, as a United States senator, I would join 49 other senators on a letter to the NFL demanding that the Washington Redskins change their name. When people come up to me to talk about Saturday Night Live, they almost always mention my on-camera work, whether it was our Franken and Davis show within the show, the Al Franken Decade, my one-man mobile uplink unit, or Stuart Smalley. But at the end of the day, Tom and I were writers. And because we are part of a great writing staff with a cast that included gifted writers like Chevy and Danny, and performers who could create hilarious characters for themselves, like Billy Murray's Lounge Singer or Gilda's Roseanne Rosanna Dana and Emily Latella, Tom and I collaborated together and separately with others on the show. Of the original cast, Danny was the one we teamed up with the most. He and Tom created the Coneheads after taking a trip together to Easter Island. Tom and I wrote Danny as Julia Child bleeding to death after cutting herself deboning a chicken. We collaborated with him on sleazy characters like Erwin Mainway, purveyor of dangerous toys for kids like Bagel Glass. Danny played two presidents with his mustache, a hyper-competent Jimmy Carter early in his term, taking phone calls with Billy Murray's Walter Cronkite and masterfully talking down a young man on a bad acid trip, played by Tom, of course. And an inebriated Nixon talking to White House portraits during those stormy final days. I worked with so many talented men and women, going through exhilarating but also sometimes very difficult periods of their lives. Putting on a live 90-minute comedy show week after week can be thrilling, and it can also be painfully stressful. And of course, we were all of a very tender age. People had sex and fell in love, but mostly had sex. I personally had 227 sexual encounters during my 15 years at SNL, all of them with Franny. A show week at SNL was kind of crazy. On Monday around 5 p.m., the cast and writing staff would crowd into Lauren's office where we'd meet the host. Lauren would introduce him or her. This week our host is Burt Reynolds, and we'd applaud politely. Then I'd yell excitedly, "And next week, Steve Martin!" We'd all cheer and go nuts. "Welcome to the show, Bert." During the meeting, writers and cast would pitch ideas. Most of them were half-baked at best. Sometimes they were fake ideas just to cover for the fact that you had nothing. You could see the terror growing in the host's eyes as he or she heard lame idea after lame idea. But the meeting served a purpose. Often someone's idea would spark one of your own. After the meetings, things would start percolating. I like that VD caseworker idea. What if you did this with it? Blah, blah, blah. During SNL's lifespan, the show has been at its best when there's been an equilibrium between the writing staff and the cast. When the cast dominates, we see popular recurring characters beaten into the ground. When the writers dominate, there's a lot of interesting stuff that the audience doesn't find all that interesting or all that funny. Read Through was on Wednesday afternoon, so Tuesday night was writing night. As the season wore on, we'd start later and later, and soon Tuesday night became an all-nighter. Woody Allen once said that writing comedy is either easy or it's impossible. When it's easy, there is nothing more fun. Conversely, when it's impossible, there is nothing quite as anxiety-provoking. To this day, I still have nightmares that it's a Tuesday night at SNL, and I cannot think of a thing. After read-through, Lauren would huddle with the host and the production staff to decide what sketches were going to be put into rehearsal. This was a complex calculus. What works? What does the host like? What sketches bump with each other? You can't have two Oval Office pieces. What combination of sets will fit into the studio? How many cast members are being served by the material? Lauren put the writers in charge of guiding their own piece through the week. Essentially, writers were the producers of their own sketches. That meant hanging around after read-through to answer any questions Lauren or the production staff might have. Can we recast this? Can you put it in a smaller set? Talk to Eugene or Leo, the set designers. Thursdays was for promos and camera blocking. You'd work with graphics, makeup, and hair, maybe props. The satellite dish mounted on the helmet for my one-man mobile uplink unit was a flying saucer sled with a basketball pump sticking out. Thursday night was late night as well. Writers would sit around the read-through table, rewriting. Usually sketches were improved, often with the most memorable jokes coming from the table. Rob Schneider wrote a piece called Massive Head Wound Harry about a cheery guy, Dana Carvey, with a massive head wound who bums out everybody at the party because of his massive head wound. During the Thursday late night rewrite session, Tom came up with the idea of rubbing Dana's bandage with cooked shrimp and having a blind guy with a guide dog enter at the end. Sure enough, the dog found Dana sitting on the couch and tugged the bandage. As the dog kept tugging, the audience howled with laughter, Dana finally cheerily saying, "He must smell my dog." Sometimes everyone knew a sketch was shaky at best, and we do our best to make it work. This was known as turd polishing. It could be a tough room. In the wee hours, things could get pretty dark and raunchy. Around the time that the term hostile work environment came into the lexicon, Christine Zander, a one-of-a-kind writer with the world's best Gatling gun laugh, who worked at the show for 7 seasons, developed a running joke for just these occasions. Dear Lawsuit Diary. Friday was a long day of rehearsal, and it often included writing something new for the cold opening, the sketch at the beginning that ends with Live from New York, it's Saturday night. The benefit of doing a live comedy show is that you can react to breaking news. The drawback is that you have to react to breaking news. If the country learns on a Friday that the Surgeon General said that teaching masturbation to kids is a good idea, you better have a take on Saturday. On Saturday morning, some of us would come in and write jokes for Weekend Update. Then a full day of rehearsals, hopefully, but almost never running through every sketch of the show. Then dinner, while the music guests did a sound check and run through for cameras. Then dress rehearsal at 8, ending at 9:50, meaning we were 20 minutes over. A quick turnaround. Lauren decides what's in, what's out. You want your sketch in? Lose 2 minutes. Quick meeting in Lauren's 9th floor office, where everyone sees the new running order. Some cast and writers are elated, some devastated. Lauren gives notes in shorthand. The writers call out cuts and rewrites. Cast absorbs them. Have a good show, everybody. Cue cards, make the changes. Cast gets in the wardrobe and wigs. The band is playing warm-up for the studio audience. It's 11:30. Maybe the studio audience is hot and laughing at everything. We need more cuts. Or maybe the audience isn't laughing. Maybe that's because we have a hot band and their fans got tickets because they all know someone who has an uncle who works in ad sales at NBC. Put that sequence back in this sketch. No? Doesn't make sense with the other cuts? Okay, let's run a commercial parody after Massive Head Wound Harry. The show ends at 1 a.m. The cast gets out of their costumes and makeup and roll around to the after party at some restaurant around 1:45. It's hard to come down from the adrenaline of performing live for 10 million Americans. 2 or 3 hours of discussing what worked and what didn't, introducing your friends from back home to George Harrison. At some point, the sun comes up. You stumble home, sleep till 2 in the afternoon, read the Sunday Times, catch some football, and have dinner with your boyfriend or girlfriend, or in my case, your wife. Your clock is all screwed up, so around midnight Sunday night, you start thinking of new ideas for the next week. And then it all starts again, Monday morning. Okay, Monday afternoon. Okay, Monday evening. But Monday.